It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going exploring. Iowa is a long way from the ocean and from the Amazon rainforest, but we are all connected, and the way we live and the decisions we make here in Iowa impact ecosystems that are very different from our own. Later in the hour, we'll meet David Thorson. He's an Iowan who became the first American sailor in history to navigate the Northwest Passage in both directions. My first guest today is Celine Cousteau. She's an explorer, a self-described oceanaut, and a filmmaker. If her name sounds familiar, that's because she is the granddaughter of Jacques Cousteau. She'll be speaking this evening at 7 o'clock at Drake University in the Sussman Theater, and the event is open to the public, but tickets are required. You can find out more about the event on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio. Hello, Celine.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
That's my pleasure.
Now, growing up in the family that you grew up in, of course, we all know about your very famous grandfather, but your father was also an explorer and a filmmaker. When did you first start going out onto the ocean and being a part of some of these expeditions?
As a child, I didn't actually get to go out much on expedition. My mother was insistent on us having a, quote, normal childhood, whatever that means. but at 9 years old, I was able to join my grandfather on a two-week expedition to the Amazon and flew down with him and stayed 2 weeks aboard Calypso. And we sailed the Amazon at that time. Him and his team were there for 18 months total. And obviously that had a huge influence on my life and my decision to continue being involved in the work that my family's doing, but also specifically in the Amazon.
And when you were on that expedition with your grandfather, he actually arranged small adventures for you to go on?
Well, yes. I mean, essentially the crew was like extended family. And so I became a bit of a little sister to all the crew members on board. And you know, every now and then I got to go out on a short exploration, as you said. We were gathering piranhas for the scientists to study, so I got to go out in a canoe and catch piranhas to bring back to the boat. We went and to shore to gather bananas and hiked into the middle of the jungle with his family and chose bananas from his field. Obviously very unique experiences for a nine-year-old.
Yeah, definitely. And it is, you've written the Amazon that really has a special place in your heart. While you love the ocean and exploring in the ocean, the Amazon, you have a special connection to it. Why do you think that is?
I think it has a lot to do with that experience when I was nine and having really had my eyes opened at that influential age and being taken there and not assumed that I was too little, too young. But being given the opportunity and a place to really be a part of the work of my family, even as a nine-year-old observer, being given the responsibility there, we actually rescued a small pygmy marmoset. It's a very small monkey, and it was my job for 2 weeks to make sure that it was taken care of and fed. And I think all of those on a psychological level really harvested something in me that was, you know, the independent being, and it was in the context of the Amazon. So I think the context itself was very influential. And I also believe a place chooses you. I don't think we just choose a place. So somehow the Amazon has chosen me, and I've listened.
Even though you had that early connection, it wasn't a given that you would follow in the footsteps of your father and your grandfather. What brought you back to this life?
It's a wonderful opportunity, first of all, but I did, my background, as you were saying, is quite different. I studied psychology in my undergraduate studies and intercultural relations in my master's, so was very much interested in human behavior and the way that we think, but inevitably, you know, being surrounded by a grandfather, a father, a mother, a grandmother who traveled the world, especially at a time in which they did, where it really was true exploration, must have stayed with me, and nature and nurture combined. But I had the opportunity in 2006. My father was working on a series of documentaries for PBS, and I had the opportunity of joining the team. I offered my help in terms of logistics and planning for the expeditions and was quickly shoved in front of the camera to start doing interviews. So I found myself in front of and behind the scenes, in essence, and it just felt natural.
And was there a moment where you realized this is what I should be doing?
It was a series of moments. I know that we as humans, we love that one sort of turning point in our life story, but it was a series of moments. And one of those was in the Arctic, actually. We were filming the gray whale migration from Baja California to Barrow, Alaska. And up in Barrow, it's Arctic tundra on one side and Arctic Ocean on the other. And it just all came together to make sense. My growing up in the family I did and seeing the work that they did, not just exploring, but also understanding and educating about our human connection to the natural world. And then my own preference for being outdoors and being part of something active and something beyond just myself and feeling like I can contribute to something greater than just self. And then the side of it that's the adventure, the beauty of being out in nature. And when you do nature documentary filming, you don't really have a schedule because animals show up when they want to and nature does what it does. And I love that.
Now, for people who hear about what you do or watch the films and think about this life, the idea of the adventure and some of the really amazing experiences that you get to have, that's just so thrilling and inviting. And of course, a lot of people dive for fun and love to spend time on the ocean. What are the parts of it that you do just because you love it, just because it's fun?
A lot of it, actually. Diving just for fun is something that's a little bit foreign to me because I don't have quite a lot of time to do that. But the moments that I have done that, I really put myself in the place of the recreational diver. And it is such an amazing place of, one, luxury, and I don't mean that financially, but a place of luxury where you get to be completely surrounded in this liquid environment. You get to be an observer of this world that is so different from ours here on land. It's almost meditative, and you don't need to go very far. You can sit still in one place and just watch the world go by. So that side of the oceans, I think, is also healing. You know, a lot of people go to the ocean side for their holidays, which I think is very significant in terms of our own well-being and what we seek when we do look for a place of rest. And I think that the oceans in general have also this sense of mystery. For me, I have not seen and discovered everything. I have not seen all the animals of the underwater world. And so there's always something to look forward to there.
As someone who has spent a lot of time on the ocean in your lifetime, you're not particularly old, but I know that this is an ecosystem. There are many ecosystems within the ocean that are fragile and are in danger. Are there changes that you have seen in your lifetime that you could compare something you saw as a child to something now?
Well, I think more than anything, what gives me reference is what people are doing about what is negative. And that is what keeps me going, honestly, because we hear a lot of negative impacts on our oceans, ocean acidification and pollution and plastic pollution in the oceans. But there are also just amazing people and organizations that are trying to create change and create positive change. So what I have seen in my lifetime is more impact of people who really care and are trying to make a difference, from someone trying to grow coral off the coast of Mexico to an organization that is trying to prevent plastic pollution, to educators talking about ocean acidification. And I think all of that has such tremendous value and really needs to start being integrated into our everyday lives.
With so many problems in the world and so much pollution, and we'll talk about invasive species and things like that in a moment, I'm curious, because you started going out on these expeditions with your grandfather, and you clearly just fell in love with, for example, the Amazon and had these amazing experiences. I'm curious about your feelings about environmental education, because sometimes today when kids are educated about the environment, there's such an emphasis on the problems that just personally, I fear that they're not getting an opportunity to fall in love with the environment that they're supposed to care about. And I'm curious about when you started thinking about the problems. When was that introduced to you?
Gosh, it's hard to even answer that. When was a problem introduced to me? it started more of my awareness in my place in the environment and my connection to it. And so I was never disconnected from the natural world. I think what happens now is that we become more and more disconnected from it, and sometimes out of circumstance, but a lot of the times, out of lack of access or lack of focus on the environment as something important or integral to our lives. As far as when I became aware of problems, I guess that was much more in my adult age, and seeing the detriment that was happening in the oceans. And the stories that we tell as documentary filmmakers or writers or public speakers often does focus on stories of issues, but it also focuses on stories of heroism and stories of positive action. As far as education and environmental education is concerned, I think it needs to become just a natural part of our curriculum from an early age on, in that a child has the power to behave differently and make decisions differently. Because at the end of the day, or at the beginning of the day, it's a question of choices throughout our day. What do we choose to eat? Are we aware of sustainable fisheries? But if we're not aware of it, that's part of our educational mishap, is we need to integrate that. We need to connect every student and every adult to our food systems, which includes our oceans, on just a very basic level. That would be one way of reconnecting people to the environment. But if we don't integrate it into the school system, unless we really have some campaign of educating parents, then how are we to expect children to grow up with this as naturally part of who they are? So that needs to happen at a much higher level, is that the educational system could really benefit from more of this learning.
We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Celine Cousteau. She is an explorer, an oceanaut, and a filmmaker. She is speaking this evening at 7 o'clock at Drake University in the Sussman Theater. And this event is open to the public, but tickets are required. And you can find out more about that. There's a link on our Facebook page. Of course, you can also look it up on the Drake news page and find out more information. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. And in a little while, we'll also introduce David Thorson. He is an Iowan who became the first American sailor in history to navigate the Northwest Passage in both directions. He lives now on the shores of Lake Okoboji. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking with explorers this hour, and my guest right now is Celine Cousteau. She's an explorer, an oceanaut, and a filmmaker. She'll be speaking this evening at Drake University in the Sussman Theater at 7 o'clock. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll also invite explorer David Thorson to join the conversation. He is an Iowan and a photographer and also an adventurer. And we'd love for you to join the conversation as well with your questions at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Celine, here in Iowa, we do think about ourselves as being a long way from the ocean. And on Talk of Iowa, we've done a number of shows over the last few years about our connection to the Gulf of Mexico and the dead zone and what's going on in the Mississippi River, the choices that we make here in Iowa. But as an individual, let's say I'm not a farmer, I'm not making choices about what's being done with a large tract of land. What kind of decisions do you think we need to be more mindful of with regard to our impact on the oceans?
As a landlocked state, you're definitely connected to the oceans, as you just stated, through the river systems. And if anybody here eats anything that comes out of the oceans, then that right there is a very obvious connection. So I think the first thing individuals can do is really look at their food choices. And if they have the ability to choose sustainable seafood, then they should make that choice. There's a great app called the Seafood Watch app that you can download on your phone. And when you go to a restaurant or you go to a supermarket, just consult the Seafood Watch app and see, you know, if the fish that you're choosing is sustainably caught, or if perhaps there are any kind of health concerns for you as a consumer. Anything that has to do with pollution as well, just individual pollution in your home, so from the products that you use to clean your home to the products that you purchase, always has a connection back to our environment in some way. So by doing a little bit of research, if you have access to the internet, which most people have now, you can find better products. And I know that eating organic and local is not an option for everybody. It's unfortunately quite expensive to do. But that's also a way to support farmers that are trying to grow organic food and get back to a food system that is healthier for us.
Now, here in Iowa, we are struggling with a number of invasive species, both plant species, insect species are a problem. And invasive species are also something that pose a serious threat to different ecosystems within the ocean. And a friend of mine who is a diver was bringing up to me the lionfish, which is a fish that is native to the Indo-Pacific, but it's an invasive species in the West Atlantic and the Caribbean. And it is there because it's a beautiful fish and it's sought after in aquariums. So people have been moving them around the world and now they cause a serious threat to the environment. With the oceans, a lot of us don't think about sort of the individual ecosystems within the different oceans and within one ocean. What should we know about invasive species and these differences?
Well, it's just like anywhere, and you were giving plants the example of plants here in Iowa, and I can't elaborate on that because I don't know about it, but that is an example that is applicable to the oceans, that even though the ocean is actually one big ocean because it's all connected, there are different ecosystems within that ocean. So the example of the lionfish is a perfect one. It's a high-profile example, and you can find information about it very easily. But just like anything, the lionfish is not endemic to all places in the ocean. It is a very voracious fish species and is a very efficient hunter. It often takes over different coral reef ecosystems that it is not native to, and it's very detrimental to other fish populations, which is why it's become a big problem. And they're also efficient reproducers. The solution is a tough one because it requires hunting, which you can imagine. I mean, hunting a fish in an ocean is not like corralling a cow. And so
it's a lot more like trying to take care of invasive insects, I would think.
That's a good example. Yes, it's a little bit tougher. But at the same time, you know, and again, I'll cite an example in Mexico. There's an organization working there to actually work with local fishermen to see the lionfish as a source of income, and working with chefs, teaching chefs that they can utilize the flesh of lionfish in their recipes. And so by taking this negative impact of this invasive species and turning it into an economic benefit, you actually create a system that hopefully will auto-correct or at least become nil. But it's tough.
Now, I know the next thing you are preparing to do is to go on an expedition to make a documentary in the rainforest. Can you tell me about the project?
Sure. It's called Tribes on the Edge, and it takes place in the indigenous territory called Vale do Javari in the Brazilian Amazon. It's a place I visited in 2007 when my father and I were filming a documentary called Return to the Amazon, going back to places my grandfather had been to in the early 80s. And one of those places was this indigenous territory. And the experience I had there was life-changing by no exaggeration in terms of learning about the high rates of hepatitis these tribes have, with hepatitis A at 80%, hepatitis B at 26%, and then cases of C and D.
And that's because of contact
with outsiders.
With outsiders.
Yes. And this is in history now. So, you know, it's several generations later, because most of the tribes that have been contacted in that area have been contacted for the past 70 years. So that's about three generations. And the uncontacted tribes are yet living in isolation. In 2010, one of the indigenous representatives that I had met at that time got in touch with me and said that they wanted our help in telling their stories to the world. And on a very basic level, it was really about creating a global knowledge of their existence to help them survive, because they are very realistically afraid of going extinct from these diseases, from invasion, from potential change to their ancestral land demarcation, the threat of oil companies coming in, the threat of dams, as we have seen all over the world, is detrimental to indigenous tribes. But here is a territory that is in a state of prevention. It is demarcated as indigenous territory. And so what we're going to try to do with a documentary at its core, We're going to try to create global awareness of the existence of these peoples and their plight to have the choice in their lives. At a deeper level, it will include an engagement and education campaign to be launched, hopefully in Brazil first, because this is where it really needs to happen, but then internationally by bringing in supporters from all around the world in different areas of industry, not just in environment or human rights. But we're bringing in a chef from Brazil. We're bringing in a fashion designer also from Brazil who support these kinds of human rights issues. And we are going to start seeking application for UNESCO Biosphere Reserve.
And how long are you intending to spend in this area?
It depends on the expedition. So I've been down there in April of last year for a week to film. Went to Brasilia to film with government and non-government organizations in November of last year. Did a full expedition this year in May. Brought down a team of 7 for 2 weeks to film in the area. And we're now looking for funding to finish the film to go back in May of next year to the other tribes. This area is the size of Austria. It's a very complex place to actually function because of the windy river systems and the distance village to village. It requires quite a lot of logistics and planning.
Now, in working on a documentary, you are also describing life as an activist at the same time and organizing all of these events and the support to try to create change and to protect these people. Do you ever feel like there's a conflict of interest in being an activist but also documenting what you're seeing?
There isn't for me. I don't profess to be completely objective. I was asked in this case by the indigenous tribes to tell their story, and that's what I'm there to do. Unlike a journalist who may be working for a specific television network or taking a point of view, maybe in the same way. I'm documenting what's happening, and the truth will show itself through this film. I also feel that as documentary filmmakers, if we are able to, we have a responsibility to doing something more for our subject. And in this case, although I do a lot of short films about cause-focused organizations through my nonprofit Cause-Centric Productions, this is taking on a greater level, and I feel that it deserves that attention.
In this day and age when I think a lot of us have the idea that we know everything about our Earth and that it's at our fingertips, we can just Google it, right? Are you ever amazed by what there is still left to discover?
I am, actually. The word explorer is always kind of a fuzzy thing for me because is there something left to explore? At the same time, if you're exploring it for the first time, you're an explorer in that moment because you're discovering it through your eyes and your knowledge and your awareness. So I do think there's a lot left to be explored because that's an individual definition for each person to discover.
I'm talking with Celine Cousteau. She is an explorer. She's also a self-described oceanaut and a filmmaker. She's speaking tonight at Drake University. And you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And now I want to bring David Thorson into the conversation. He is a photographer and an adventure sailor. He is the only American sailor to ever navigate the Northwest Passage in both directions, and in June of 2010, he completed the 28,000-mile circumnavigation of North and South America. He'll be introducing Celine Cousteau at the event this evening, and he lives in Iowa. Hello, David.
Hello, Charity. Hello, Celine.
Hi, David.
Thank you so much for being here today. And earlier, I was talking with Celine about the adventures that she went on with her grandfather as a child and her exposure to the family business. Now, growing up in Iowa, you are a long way from the ocean. What was your connection?
Well, it's a little harder for us who live in the middle of the country to get to the ocean. I think Celine obviously has a genetic link, obviously, a direct link to the ocean. For those of us who live here, it's a little more difficult. But my grandfather had quite a library of books about the ocean and boats and yachts and ships, and I spent a lot of time looking at those books as a kid. And then my mom taught me how to sail at Okoboji when I was about 5 or 6 years old. So I started just doing that as a kid and playing outside as we did all the time and creating my own adventures. And eventually the question comes up, you know, so David, how did you get to the ocean and sail on the ocean? And for me, that answer is easy. I met a hog farmer from southern Minnesota, and the rest is history.
Well, that doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't. But my mentor in sailing was Roger Swanson, and it turns out that he sailed over 200,000 nautical miles around the world and lived 35 miles from here on a farm in southern Minnesota and made that his home. And he obviously had a direct connection to the sea and to the oceans, and he introduced me to ocean sailing.
And there, as I mentioned earlier with Celine, when we think about this life of adventure, it sounds so attractive to people, although it's hard to get paid to do it, I think is a problem that a lot of us had. So was there a, once you fell in love with sailing on the ocean, how did you go about carving out a career?
Well, my career has been about freelance photography, writing, and also some film work. I've done a number of documentaries with Iowa Public Television on my travels and adventures, I think three or four now, and also quite a lot of magazine work, contract photography, and I own a gallery here in the Lakes area, so I do fine art photographic print work also. So I've tried to combine what I do to work hard when I'm home and then hit it hard on the road and on the ocean, trying to create new work and get out there and photograph nature in the extreme parts of the world.
I want to talk with you more about your adventures, what you've seen in just a moment. I also want to get to the phones. Mike is on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
My wife and I split time between Cedar Falls and Santa Barbara, California, where I think maybe Celine lives, or I know that her family has a foundation there, and we are ocean swimmers and spend lots of time in the ocean. One of the things when we're out there on coastal California, we go to Trader Joe's, they will ask about giving us plastic bags, or they may charge us for it. And so they're very conscientious about it because the plastic bags are an absolute destroyer of our oceans. They're just awful. And I come back to Iowa, and I think the consciousness is not there. I'll go to Hy-Vee, and I'll buy maybe 8 items, and it comes in, you know, 5-6 different plastic bags. So I think that one of the things we could do here in Iowa to help repair that situation is just simply quit using so many doggone plastic bags, or putting, you know, only one item in a plastic bag, and basically bring in our own recyclable bags, which is very common on coastal California.
Well, and Mike, you won't be asked about plastic bags at Trader Joe's in Santa Barbara anymore, because
that's
just
right.
Yesterday the plastic bag ban in California went into effect.
Yep.
So, but Celine, would you like to respond to that? Plastic bags, there are a lot of people who are concerned about them, but here in Iowa they seem fairly benign.
Well, again, that goes back to education, and I think you're completely right about the plastic bag, is that it is it's also symbolic, but it is very important for us to not use single-use plastics, even if we reuse them for our trash. I think that there are better options than plastic bags. Once we start taking certain actions into the law and put them into effect, then it just creates a necessity for change, and people adapt. So I very much believe that California, in that case, is really leading the charge on this.
And what do you see in the oceans that makes it necessary for California to ban plastic bags?
Well, I mean, they have a tremendous coastline, so they have a very keen understanding of their direct impact. But most places I've gone diving, I've seen some form of plastic pollution. And it's truly sad to see, because it's completely preventable.
And can you give me a specific example, though? I mean, we do try to make it out to the coast, but when you see plastic pollution in the ocean, what do you see?
Plastic bags, plastic bottles, also aluminum cans. I mean, anything that people would use or consume along the coastline would be one good example. But anything that gets thrown in the rivers has an opportunity of making its way to the oceans. And even in the rivers itself, it's not a good thing. Floating plastic bags in the water, I would say, is a pretty stark example.
Which can pose an immediate threat to any wildlife that would encounter it?
It poses an immediate threat in terms of entanglement or ingestion, but also the chemicals in the plastic itself. The plastic never fully disappears. It will break down into little microscopic pieces, but it's never really gone.
We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Celine Cousteau and David Thorson this hour. Celine Cousteau is an explorer and a filmmaker. David Thorson is a photographer and adventure sailor. They'll both be at Drake University tonight. David Thorson will be introducing Celine Cousteau this evening at 7 p.m. at Drake University. You can find out more about the event on our Facebook page and join our conversation. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with explorers. Celine Cousteau is with us on the line. She is a self-described oceanaut and a filmmaker. Soon she'll be going on an expedition. She's working on a documentary about indigenous tribes in the Brazilian rainforest. With me also is Iowan David Thorson. He's a photographer and an adventure sailor. And David, we haven't talked very much about your adventures. You fell in love with the sea and sailing. When did you go on your first major voyage?
My first major voyage was in 1991, and really my first time sailing on the ocean, I flew to South Africa to Cape Town and sailed 6,000 miles, 38 days nonstop from Cape Town to Ushuaia, Argentina, and then continued later on down to Antarctica and spent most of the year sailing about 12,000 miles. So a big adventure right away to get my feet wet out there. And I absolutely fell in love with sailing and the ocean and just that feeling of being out there on the water.
You have wound up spending a lot of time in the Arctic. When was your first experience there?
Well, in 1992, when Roger and I were down in Antarctica, we kind of hatched this idea of attempting the Northwest Passage. And we went north in 1994, so 20 years ago this summer, we had actually been to the Arctic for our first time. We tried the Northwest Passage. There was one other boat there, a small French boat. So there were two boats and nine people in the entire world there in 94. We didn't make it. It was a different world then, a lot of ice. And we retreated out of there only to return 13 years later and sailed 7,000 miles in 73 days all the way through the Northwest Passage and never touched one piece of ice.
Now, that sounds like an incredibly successful journey, but it also speaks to major changes that have been taking place in the environment in the Arctic, right?
Absolutely. And in those 13 years from 1994 to 2007, there was about a 40% decrease in the ice just in those 13 years. So I kind of feel in 2007, I was an eyewitness to a change in climate, and it directly and profoundly changed my life, and I've kind of dedicated my life since that point to working on issues of climate change and education and ocean and sea awareness issues.
So in the 20 years that you have had actual physical experience in the Arctic, can you describe the changes you're seeing?
Well, the changes are many and varied. They permeate cultures. They have changed the Arctic dramatically in how the wildlife is reacting in every ecosystem, how hunters and fishermen and families are going out for their summer hunting camps, changes weather windows. But the biggest thing is how the ice is retreating far away from the coastline, far away from the coast of Alaska, hundreds of miles sometimes. And, you know, we all know about the polar bear issues, but wildlife is retreating and changing and trying to adapt very quickly. And the people who live on the shores of these villages in the Arctic are having to adapt also quickly to melting permafrost and changes in their hunting and fishing cycles, changes of season. Species are changing their breeding seasons. So it's changing in so many ways. That's why I like the Arctic. It's probably the most dynamic area on Earth right now. It's been impacted greatly by a change in climate. It has a lot of interesting and fascinating issues with energy exploration and extraction right now, which is endangering the entire region. So I encourage everyone to take a look at the Arctic as an area of interest and study.
Now, as Celine said earlier, she said, as documentary filmmakers, we have a responsibility to do more for our subjects. As you are sailing in the Arctic, taking amazing photographs in the Arctic, what do you feel your responsibility is?
I concur with Celine in what she said. As a documentarian, I don't really go into it with a point of view, but I go into it with open eyes and try to document what I see and let people decide. Even on the issue of climate change, the way I approach it in my presentations and discussions is to just present what I've seen as an eyewitness. I don't claim to be a world-renowned scientist. I just know what I've seen just in my short lifetime going to the Arctic. And also going back to one thing that Celine said about being in Barrow, where I spent much time also, she said with the tundra on one side and the Arctic Ocean on the other, this was very much our theme with our sail around the Americas, that we are interconnected, that this interconnectedness is so important. And our theme was one island, one ocean, that we're really just one big island with the two Americas surrounded by one body of water. And everything that happens out on the water comes back to affect us on the land and vice versa. So it's these interconnections which are so important. And I know Celine will be talking about that tonight.
We are talking this hour with Celine Cousteau and also David Thorson. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talks and email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And the marine biology class at Central Campus in Des Moines is listening, and Yvonne is on the line. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello.
Hi there. What's your question?
Oh, we in this class wanted to know, how do sea beans go from the Amazon River to across the world and around the world?
All right. Celine? First of all, I don't know what sea beans are, so can you help us out with that first and then answer Yvonne's question?
Well, I actually didn't hear it, so okay. If you could repeat it, that would be great.
He is asking how, and correct me if I'm wrong, Yvonne, how sea beans go from the Amazon River to around the world?
Wow, yes. That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer.
What are sea beans?
Wait, you want me to answer that?
Sure.
Oh, okay. They're seeds from trees and vines that are washed out from the sea through waterways such as rivers and streams. And then they drift to foreign shores.
Okay. So,
well, I would imagine that, just like, you know, any river that carries its contents out to the oceans, probably the best place to look at is the ocean currents and see where the Amazon basin and drains and where the currents would take those seeds. I would imagine that more than an invasive species, that is more of a natural flow of connections between our waterways. But I haven't actually studied sea beans and their trajectory down the Amazon, but not a bad idea.
Yvonne, thank you so much for your call. And I think that does speak to this interconnectedness that we've been talking about in many ways throughout the hour. The fact that something can fall from a tree into the Amazon River and wind up on a foreign shore also tells us a lot about what falls into the Iowa River or the Cedar River in Iowa can do as it travels. Celine, when you think about our river system in Iowa, our river systems around the world, what should we be thinking about with the water quality in a landlocked state like Iowa?
Well, as we were referring to it earlier, and I do think David can also speak to this as an Iowan, but the waterways here in Iowa connect back to the oceans, and if you utilize anything from the ocean ecosystem, especially the Gulf, that creates a direct connection between your landlocked state and the oceans. I don't think any state can be considered landlocked, because if you look at water patterns, whether it's through our skies or our rivers, everything comes back to us in a cyclical way. So the more we understand about that connection, the better off we are. And again, I keep referencing food source as an easy way to understand how that comes back to us through our plate. So, you know, from state to ocean and ocean back to state.
Joe is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, as I listen, I remember I did a hitch in the Coast Guard on an icebreaker, and I was in the Arctic twice and Antarctica once in between times for Operation Deep Freeze 73, they called it, but that was a while back. And one of the times on the icebreaker off the north slope of Alaska, one of the things we were doing was through use of like an advanced magnetometer, jumping a huge spark across a gap in the water. We were taking readings off the what is now the oil reserve up there. We were exploring that. My question has to do with something else, and that is more of a geologic thing, I guess. I've heard some talk of frozen gases in forms of like ice deposits on the Arctic floor that, if they were to melt up, would significantly impact our climate. Have you heard anything along those lines of particularly frozen ice that is, once the Arctic warms up, going to be released into the atmosphere and have a major impact?
Joe, let me direct that to David. Anything about frozen gas deposits in the Arctic floor that may be melting and leaking?
I think that's been in the news recently, actually, that some scientists have just discovered that some of, I think we're talking about methane here, that some of that methane is actually starting to reach the surface that has been trapped on the floor of the ocean in the Arctic Ocean. And I think that's mostly in the Siberian side of the ocean right now. Methane is a very strong greenhouse gas, much stronger than CO2. And there are gigatons of methane stored in the frozen tundra in the Arctic and in the Arctic Ocean. Right now, scientists are studying that as one of the key contributors to changing climate, and hopefully that those gases can remain sequestered.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for your call. And Celine, back to the plastic bag issue. Linda from Cedar Rapids asks, what are better trash can liners than using reused grocery store bags, since you mentioned that earlier?
I know. And I don't think that there's a perfect answer to that. I mean, short of using less of them, composting would be a great way to reduce the contents of that plastic bag and of that trash. Even if you don't have a very prolific garden, I'm sure that there are farmers that would take your compost. Creating less trash to begin with, so really reducing our plastic waste, or any of our waste for that matter, from the start. I would have to do a little bit of research to find out if there is an option that is just as durable as the plastic bag. I know that's something that consumers worry about, that if they're going to throw their trash in it, will it disintegrate in their hands? I'm sure that if it doesn't exist already, there might be something that's in the making.
You know, the two of you have these amazing opportunities, and you've made these opportunities for yourself to really travel the world and see these environments firsthand, and you can see the impacts that all of us are having on environments that most of us will never see firsthand. What are some suggestions that you have for those of us who are landlocked about getting to know our oceans better? Celine?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
If we're landlocked in Iowa, what are some of the ways that you feel we should get to know our oceans better?
Well, I mean, again, it goes back to the question of education in schools. Central Campus is a perfect example. They have a fantastic marine biology class that are listening now, and that can be an example to spread to other schools. I also think that, you know, if somebody is interested in ocean issues, just because you're landlocked doesn't mean you can't contribute. There's a lot of fantastic nonprofit organizations that could use support, both in terms of funding and voluntary work. So I think that those are some key places. And then again, going back to food choices, that if there's anything that you're eating out of the oceans, start educating yourself as to what you're eating. Is it sustainably caught and is it healthy?
And David, I know you've expressed concern that we know, in your words, more about outer space than we do about the ocean.
I think that's true. Celine's family is probably the most important family that I can think of in our lifetime, in the past few generations, about really turning the public on to the ocean and what's really beneath the surface. We we look at the surface. We don't really know what's going on underneath, and that's why it's so important, the work that Celine and her family has done and so many other explorers around the world. So I do just a little bit of diving, but I mostly have sailed the waters of the world, and I know just a very, very little about what is going on under the surface, and that's why it's so important to have all of these underwater explorers that are available to show us and teach us what's happening in this blue world.
And you've expressed concern that we're going to destroy the oceans before we actually understand them.
I think that's happening. There's, as Celine said, it's easy to look at many of the negative impacts right now and get caught up in that, but there are so many positive things going on and so many people working around the world to help that it does give me hope that we can turn things around. And we really have to. And that's part of what Celine's doing, what I'm trying to do, so many people around the world, is to talk to kids and get them fired up and inspired about becoming explorers or teachers or scientists, because it's really their generation that is going to have to cure some of these ills that we've created.
And what is your next adventure, David?
Well, I've met another sailor from Colorado. I seem to meet them all in the Midwest or mountains or something, but I'm working on another project up north, potentially, and it will involve climate discussions and sailing into remote areas and having conversations and filming some documentary work with folks who are impacted directly or have knowledge like scientists about what's happening with changing climate in the north.
David Thorson is a photographer and adventure sailor. He will be introducing Celine Cousteau this evening at the event at Drake University. And Celine, we mentioned earlier that you are heading back to the Amazon. When can we expect to see the documentary you're working on?
I wish I could say it would be sooner than later, but if we are able to find the funding to finish filming in May, we hope to have the documentary finished before the end of 2015.
All right. And when you think about getting the word out with the way that media has changed so much, what is your most powerful way, do you feel, to reach people?
I think every method is necessary, but I actually really like being able to speak to live audiences. There is a much more personal connection that is made there. It is not necessarily time efficient because of needing to travel, and then my carbon footprint increases. But I think if you can influence a small group of people to make great change, then it creates a real domino effect.
Well,
so I will continue to do that.
Celine, thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Celine Cousteau will be speaking this evening at Drake University at 7 o'clock in the Sussman Theater. The event is open to the public, but tickets are required. So you can find out more about the event and how to get in touch with the organizers on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa. Mm-hmm.